This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2013, held at Faith Builders on August 6th through 9.
Did anyone, while we'll wait just a little bit here, make sure nobody wants to slip in. Did anybody have a question yesterday they would have liked to ask that we didn't have time for? I know somebody that was in here yesterday had written some down and we got interrupted before we got to finish talking about everything. Okay, well, we might go ahead and get started. Thanks for taking care of that for me. If you were not, and there's a handout right there. If you were not here yesterday, anybody that was not here yesterday? Okay, so I'm Carolyn Martin, and I teach at Hickory Hollow Christian School in Dayton, Virginia, which it's close to Harrisonburg. They almost run together. This coming year I'll have 10 first graders, 5 girls and 5 boys, and I can't ever remember being exactly matched like that before. So welcome to the workshop if you've not weren't here yesterday, and welcome back for all of you all that were here yesterday. First grade is unlike any of the other grades in school because the year ends up vastly different than it begins. You get these babies in at the beginning of the year, and sometimes I wonder, are we getting anywhere? And then in April, we have a 2-week kindergarten, and I think, they have learned some things after all. Sometimes I'm wondering, but by midterm, you're starting to move away from showing them how to do something and more teaching them what to do or what is there. You're doing more content learning. So this workshop is going to move away from learning how to read to learning what to do with what we read, from learning about numbers to working and manipulating those numbers. So I also hope to share some educational ideas that keep students enjoying school, and hopefully you'll have some students who say, like I hear some of mine say, not everybody, but usually there's one or two first graders that say, I wish we could just keep going to school all summer. They have 1 or 2 weeks of vacation and they're ready to go back to school. I wish they would do that when they're in 7th and 8th grade too, but by the middle of the year, you should know your students fairly well. They should be comfortable in your classroom, and they should have a pretty good idea of what you expect from them. You should know who has weak areas and what those weak areas are. You have slowly been, and you'll continue to shift your mode of teaching from a basic mode, where you show them every step, to a more content-rich mode. So we're going to just go through some of the subjects again and talk about ways you might do handle some of these subjects after Christmas. You're going to continue to teach new sounds and how to put those sounds together. You're going to find that long vowel sounds, and most curriculums start with long vowel. They teach the E at the end. And you're going to start working with consonant blends, and some students will find this a challenge because suddenly their neatly ordered little world of one letter, second letter, third letter, and you just can look at the whole thing and sound it out, and all of a sudden you can't just do that anymore. You've got that E at the end that you had to look at to change that vowel sound. Blends can be a little tricky, so you're going to have to work with that and not think, well, I've taught them the letters of the alphabet. They know the consonants and the short vowels, and so we've got an easy road ahead. There are a lot of mnemonics that will help make it stick, and I think in the back of the handout, again, I have my email address. If anybody would like to know what some of those are, send me an email, and I'll try to email you back with those. You're going to start working on building comprehension. Now, I hope most of you have been working with listening comprehension. You've probably been reading stories at story time. But this is going to start really working with helping students understand what they are reading. as soon as I can, which is starting as soon as they have words to read, and as soon as there's any level of independence at all, I generally have my students read all their stories to themselves first. Some of them can do that fairly well. Now, when I say I have them read to themselves first, you usually have a child that is looking at their book, and maybe they're reading a couple of words, and they might be the poorest reader in the class, but as soon as little Susie, who is the best reader in the class, shuts her book goes shut too, and you know they didn't read their material. So I will often start off with partner reading. They read to each other. And if you really have a problem, last year I had three students that I read. We just set up in a circle on the floor, and we read the stories together. The others were all reading to themselves. But that is different than just a regular oral reading class when we are really trying to work on those types of skills. So have the students start reading to themselves as soon as they can. Before you start an exercise in reading, you might want to do a pre-reading warm-up where you're going to be looking at the pictures, you look at the title. They might start scanning toward the end of the year, scanning the first part of the story to figure out who the story is about, where the story might take place. You might have your students make predictions about what the title might lead them to think, or there might be some pictures in the story. There's a story in the reader we use that has a doctor kit and some Band-Aids, and I forget the predictions they made last year that the story was about. I knew they were wild predictions, that the story didn't go there at all. Sometimes we come back then at the end and was this what they thought the story was going to be about? Leave them with some questions. Maybe that's something you will probably have to coach them in this at the beginning, but let them think about ways that something they want to find out in the story. Maybe you need to give them a question. CLE has the story question at the beginning of their stories, and usually it's something that they need to think about as they read the story. Sets the stage for the story. And if you're giving them some questions, then they're going to have something that they need to think about as they're reading the story. So we read the material to ourselves, and then we work on this slowly so they know what's going to come. This is helping them figure some things out. We make a story map. And I usually just start off with, I just draw this on the board real quickly, and might do something like that. Hey, we look for the characters. So they tell me the characters, and I might write them on the board. We look for the setting. Did it happen? Where did it happen? Is it indoors, outdoors? Did it happen long ago? Could it have happened today? What was the problem? And if they can give you the problem, they can summarize the story, probably. And then how did they solve the problem? That's how I take the different elements of the story and put it in first grade language. So I might write it out. Sometimes I don't have time to write it. We just talk about it. Usually I don't have them try to copy it. It takes them too long. Toward the end of the year this year, some of my better students were filling out a plot map on their own. Another thing that you can do is make a snapshot, which this actually was a particular worksheet that we had, but basically they were to pretend they took a snapshot of something that happened in the story. So they draw a picture of a happening in the story, and then when they're able, they can write a sentence about it. And it usually gives you a pretty good idea of how they responded to the story. There was one story in one reader where it's children in a rowboat on a pond. Well, I got speedboats, I got deep sea fishing boats from my artistic little girl. I could tell they weren't quite getting the whole picture of the story. They saw a boat and they went to what they thought about as a boat. But the snapshots are something that they enjoy doing. And then the last half of the year, we treat oral reading as a presentation. And what I like to do with this, I usually mark in their books the part they're going to read. I like to give them bigger chunks. Of course, you vary it according to what your ability is. I would rather have them read a whole page than one sentence and where their turn keeps coming up over and over. But not all children can read a whole page. Then they study that. Well, as they're studying, they're supposed to think about how they want it to sound, the expression they need to put in their piece. A lot of first graders can't read ahead far enough to think about if this is a sad sentence or an exciting sentence, and so you have a child who's reading along, all of a sudden they stop and back up and they reread it because they realize that they didn't read it correctly. Well, having them study it ahead of time helps them think about this, and they know where those exciting parts are or those grouchy parts or the ones that are easy for them to put expression in it. It also gives the poor reader more confidence because he has looked at this material. He still might read poorly, but he's not. It's not a cold read, and of course, then everybody else, the teacher included, is not quite as frustrated because we're not stopping every other word to wait and listen to them figure it out. We work on volume, how loud they read. Speed. A lot of children that can read well read as quickly as they can read. And it's really not a good reading practice. I mean, who wants to listen to them read a story that you can't understand because they're going so fast they can't understand it? I tell them, don't read faster than you talk. Most people don't talk as fast as they read. Phrasing, and I already mentioned expression, and even just being clear. Some children are loud, but they don't speak clearly. If you're tired of reading, you read a paragraph, you read the next paragraph, you read the next paragraph, and oops, I don't remember where I am anymore, so we got to stop and find where I am. And this book has a lot of other good suggestions. It's called Goodbye Round Robin. And with first graders, I don't use a lot of the ideas, but it has helped me find some ways to vary my reading. Another thing I like to do is choral reading. A lot of the poetry we do, we read chorally, and that gives the slow reader, it builds their confidence because they're reading with someone else. It also is good to help them keep a rhythm. So choral reading is a good thing to do. Poems, did I mention that? Poems are the best way to make use of that. Language arts. The last half of the year, we add language arts to our curriculum. And in first grade, this is pretty much just a continuation of the phonics program. Of course, I'm working with CLE's first grade materials. You might not have language arts at all in depending what curriculum you use, and it might be covered in your reading program. So they're working with a lot of phonics rules. CLE has just in the last year or two made available a whole bunch of charts for the different phonics sounds that even if you're not using their phonics, if you don't have any charts, these are a good source for charts. They also have them available in a little smaller size if you wanted to just show it at a class table. And nice thing about it, they have a list of words on the back that use that concept. Now you might run into, it's a list of words that use the sound. You might get into some words that they still can't read because there's other sounds in it. That gives you a springboard. We also learn some basic grammar rules. Capital letter first, you need an end mark at the end. As they're doing their own written work, have them make application of those principles within reason. You don't need to stand over with a red pen every time they write a sentence, but usually I'll say, did you have a capital letter? Do you have a period at the end? try to see that that happens. Students aren't going to learn to put periods at the end and capital letters at the beginning unless you remind them, and you remind them, and you remind them, and you remind them. And you know, you might still have fifth and sixth grade teachers who are still reminding their students to do that. I know our fifth and sixth grade teacher says, oh, she doesn't, why she can't get it in their heads. Another thing that comes up with grammar and with language arts is sentence sense. And we do a lot of oral practice with this. Teach them to recognize a sentence or a phrase. So the earth is round is a sentence, but big round earth is not a sentence. We kind of have a sense for that, but children, they need a lot of hearing of that to understand why it's a sentence or why it's not a sentence. We do a chant, which I guess it is helping them. It helps me help them think it through anyway, but we say, sentence, sentence, who, what they did, which the earth is round isn't a what they did. And then we slowly build on it, capital first and mark last. And then when we get to statements and questions, it would be tells, tells, period, period, asks, asks, question mark. And we go through that rhythm, and sometimes it helps them remember. Maybe if they don't remember it, if I go through it with them, they will, it'll click for them. A statement or a question. That can be difficult for some children, especially when they're reading something and they're struggling to read it, and then they have to think what the whole thing says. CLE teaches them to look for question words at the beginning, which I do make a chart of all their question words. That works for first grade most of the time, but there are a lot of questions that don't really begin with question words, and there's more question words than what they can remember. So we just work with that orally. Does it ask or tells? Sometimes some children pick it up, they understand. I think they usually have good comprehension, and some of them don't. Or you have a little girl like I had last year who had a speech issue, and I realized in the middle of the year, she didn't ask questions, really. She phrased all her requests in the form of a statement. She needed a drink. I can go get a drink. You knew what she wanted, she was asking, but we had to work with helping her make questions. Answering questions in complete sentences, that's a biggie. And if you try to have students write complete answers down at this level, even second and third graders, if they've not had much practice with it, that can be a struggle. So we start working with it out loud. They say, I ask them a question, and I often start with, like, what is your favorite color? Well, my favorite color is red. Or, what did you do last night? I did this. So that you can tell them, well, you need to start with what the first word is. Spelling is something you'll continue to work with. If you have time, this is a fun activity to do. We took the licorice strings and did our spelling words with that. I don't do it very often anymore because for some reason I have less time than I did when I had that class. I'm not sure what happened. But again, match your spelling words with the principle being taught. Now, some curriculums move into an actual spelling curriculum after the middle of the year, and it doesn't work quite that. You can't just match it up as well. But they do need practice spelling words with these sounds that they're using. And when you're working with phonics principles, there again, there's mnemonics you can use to help you remember the spelling rules. When you're working with phonics principles, you need to teach that each sound has its own symbol. Sometimes it's a combination of letters, like IGH or AU, AW, and they come in a particular order. I had a cousin who went to public school during a time when phonics was not being taught in the public school. Spelling is really hard for her. And I was, she's enough younger than me that I was helped tutoring her with this one time. And I realized she has the, she knows what letters go there, but she doesn't know which order they belong in. And she had no concept of sounding out words and thinking about how the sounds match up to the order that you put them in. So some children don't learn that on their own. And when children are writing their own things, allow them to have spelling variations. Actually, I'm not too picky with first grade spelling on their own writing anyway. But if they spell B-A-T-E instead of B-A-I-T, they've got the idea. Now, if you're doing spelling words like that and you're working on A-I, I know that's not right. But are we still writing stories at the middle of the year? Well, I hope so, because that's when they can really start writing stories. As soon as I think they're capable, and it depends on the class, I start moving them from just pictures to actually putting words down. And sometimes they start doing this on their own. They start labeling their pictures with words. But that's often what some of the first things they do. Just put some labels on, you know, maybe mom's name or what they were doing. If they've been telling the stories, especially if they've been telling you the stories to write down, they're going to already have a good idea of how they want the sentences to sound. So slowly move them into writing their stories down. Middle of the year, they can't spell a lot of words yet. So I have learned to not be picky with their spelling. And you have some children who like their stuff to be right, and so they change their words because they know they can't spell it. So I, you know, even though I'm not picky, and it's not at all unusual for students to leave vowels out of words when they're spelling it, especially if they haven't learned some of the vowel sounds. So you might have, say, the word double might be spelled D-B-L. That's okay for in their own composition, if I know what it means. But then a couple years ago, I started giving them what I called their journal bookmarks, where they could bring it up and I'll write the word down that they want to spell. They keep it so that when they bring it back tomorrow and need the same word, I can say, well, it's right here, and it saves me some time. If a student could spell the word, say they want to know how to spell cat and they're just not thinking, I'll say, well, break it apart, you can spell that. Or sometimes they just want to know, they've learned the two spellings for the long A, and so they're not sure which one to use, and so they just need to be told which to do. But I noticed that some of my poorer students, by allowing them to ask me how to spell a word, they were much better able to write down really what they wanted to write, not what they were comfortable writing. Give students a purpose to write. So we slowly progress from pictures to paragraphs. And I also, as we're doing this, I always have them check, did they start with a capital letter? Do they have a period at the end? Okay, they probably have a lot of run-on sentences in there, but that's the two biggies that they look at. Sometimes you can get a student who is ready to move on to figuring out where his sentences stop and start. You might work with that. Some children aren't ready for that yet. But children have different abilities. This is a good way to let them work to the best of their own ability. We did a project last year that I hope to remember to do again. We each published our own book. I told them about it a week or so ahead, that when we get to such and such a point, we're going to be writing our own stories. And I asked a few of them if they would bring their books back, so I could bring them along here. This is the first time we ever actually published a book. They wrote the stories, and then instead of them rewriting it down, because it's kind of hard for them to recopy, I went ahead and typed their story out. That also allowed me to stretch the story out over several pages or combine it if they needed it combined. And I have here an example of the best story in my class and the student who struggled the most. So I'm going to read a few of these stories. This one, I'm a little suspicious he got some ideas from his big sister at home because they had been thinking about this, and he knew what he was going to write about, and it sounds a little bit like he had some help. But this is called Al the Race Car by Alexander Good. And then, yes.
Is this the first or second grade?
This is first grade. Okay. This was in, I think we did this in April.
Okay.
So Al the Race Car. Hey, I'm Al the Race Car. Today is my first day to race. I'm sitting here waiting for the countdown to begin. 3, 2, 1, go! I took off with a screech of peeling tires. Wow, it was a wonderful day for racing. As I streaked past three cars, I felt good. Before I got to the halfway line, I was close to the head to pass. I jammed the throttle to the floor and zipped up closer, closer, closer. I almost passed him by now. Finally, I made it. Wow, I thought to myself as I caught my breath. Let's see, I can pass this boy. I jammed the throttle, then I passed him. Then I made it. I won the first race. Next Saturday, I'll race again. This time, I hope I win again. And I did. So that's an example of you're not going to get that kind of writing all the time. I would say that's a very good example. And there's another one here that says, I am a trapper by Josiah McMurray. I am a trapper. I caught a possum and a skunk and another possum and a cat. And couldn't catch a fox. I tried and tried, but I did not catch a fox. And if you notice, I kept a lot of their spelling like they did it. Now, if it was something that I knew they weren't going to be able to figure out later, or I could hardly figure out how to read it, I might have made a few corrections. But it's kind of fun to go back, for them to go back in later years and see how they used to do it. But next week, I caught a fox. Then I skunned the fox and the two possums and the skunk. The next month, I could not catch anything, and I was mad. And then this one is from one of my more learning challenged students, but with a little bit of help and me stretching it out for him, he actually came up with something he can be proud of too. This is A Waterfall by Carlton Nicely. Daddy and Mom and Luana and Rosina and I, and you can see the amount of words is less on the page, are coming down from Canada, and we stopped at a waterfall. We watched the waterfall. There was big rocks under the water. And he spells water, W-O-D-R. And we went back home. So that's not just a wonderful piece of writing, but he has something here he can feel very proud of because he actually did a very good job. And then they got to read these to the kindergartners. And they thought that was a lot of fun. I often put their work on a bulletin board so others can see it. In math, you want to continue helping students visualize concepts. So we have 100 things, 200. Have them count out 100 things, or maybe 200, or depending how many students you have, if they each count 100, you can put it all together and, well, in my case, I can have 1,000 things if they each do 100. Help them to see, to visualize it. Continue to use motion or song with your skip counting or your facts. One thing that is a good way to do this, and it actually does more than just teach them to skip count, is to do an exercise where, say, you're doing fives, and where they actually have to take their hand over the midpoint of their body. And so sometimes it's just a matter of slapping your knees like this, like 5, 10, but we got a little more complicated last year, complicated for first graders. We went 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, you know, where you're hitting your shoulders every other one. That took them a little bit to catch on, but I thought was probably good for their coordination. Sing up the scale for the 25s. job. You come up with your own tunes. Let them come up with the tunes. Sometimes they do very good at that. Some tips for the facts. Use the 10 friends, 9 and 1, 8 and 2, 7 and 3, 6 and 4. There are little stories you can use for teaching all of these. I didn't write them out for you. I kind of ran out of time. But basically with a 9 and 1, you have the 9 and 1 hides in the 9. I've kind of changed these to fit what I'm doing at the moment or what I remember. So we have an 8 and a 2. 8's hiding in the 2. The 7 and the 3, they like to hang out with each other. And the 6 and the 4, well, 6 pulls 4's tail down and curls up, and then 4 pulls 6 out straight. Sometimes if you have a little motion for that, especially the 4 and the 6, and I just jerk this way, and then they soon remember. When we're doing facts above 10, I found it works good to recite them as triplets, so I actually use Reidenstaff's Bees and Blossoms chart for this. So we have, for the 11, we have 2, actually it would be like 9, 2, 8, 3, 7, 4, 6, 5. And so what we did last year, we had what I call see, say, clap, snap, snap. Basically, they had to look at it, and they had to say it. So I was standing there pointing. But so they're looking at it, and they're saying it, and they're going 11, 9, 2, 11, 8, 3, 11, 7, 4, 11, 6, 5. Until you get all of them around, some of those beginning facts, all you have to say is 11, 9, they know what they are. Actually, last year I had students who knew their subtraction facts better than their addition facts, just because 11, 9, oh, 2, because of the rhythm of the of clapping it and snapping it. Again, sing your facts, make up your own tune. Use competition with care. Math drill lends itself to competition. It can be good. It can be a bad thing if you're not careful, because oftentimes competition eliminates the child who really needs the practice. So you need to figure out a way that you get the more practice for the child who needs more practice. Often what I'll do instead, if we do an around the world type of situation, or even if there's, you do a lineup and you have two people, and the real drill is if you say the answer, you get to go to the back of the, no, if you say the answer, you get to stay up and keep repeating the answer. Well, I always change it. If you say the answer, you go to the back of the line, because you need, the person that knows the answers doesn't need to keep saying them as much as the person who didn't know the answer. Something I did last year, we did a Who Can Say It First competition that was quite popular. I split them up in pairs of two, and I set the pairs so that it was two evenly matched students. And then they'd come up to my desk, and I would have them, you know, I'd flash the card, and they could see who could say it first. I didn't give them the cards right away. I made two stacks on my desk. For one thing, it cut down, and it saved a few seconds for me just to quickly do that. But it also allowed me to, say it was a tie, so Johnny over here doesn't have quite as many cards. I'll put it on his pile. Or even if, sometimes you could do that, you could make the piles about even without them really realizing what you were doing, and then give it to them, and they count them. And that way, they're not, if you're giving them the cards, then they're more likely to say, I said that one first, not him or whatever. We also did a competition where we split up into two groups. And here again, I evenly matched the groups. So you had slow learners, or the slower, actually some of my slower fact students were not slow learners. They just didn't recall them as quickly. And I'd set the timer for 2 minutes, and we'd go around. And so you say the first answer, you say the next answer, and so on, until the timer goes off. I count the cards. We put the number on the board. Next group's turn. And the groups compete against each other and see who could get the most facts. You have to be a little careful if there's one really slow person, because while a little bit of peer motivation can be good, you have to watch your students that they are not saying, come on, think, or making them feel like that. So competition can be good, but use caution with it. School is more than about reading, writing, and arithmetic. The main portion of time should be spent learning the basics, but adding a few more things can add spice to the day, and it can also build your bank of content knowledge that will be helpful in later grades. So let's talk about a few of these, what I call necessary extras. For Bible, we use CLE's Bible, and there might be some people who disagree with me, but I use Bible as the devotional 3 mornings a week. I use Bible class for, now I'm teaching just one grade, I can do that. It gives me a systematic approach to devotions, and it also teaches them general Bible knowledge. Science and history, I like to do science at the beginning of the year, history toward the end, and I don't have a particular curriculum I go by. We just do maybe science class 2 or 3 times a week. I did plan my projects centered around the core knowledge sequence using either kindergarten or the first grade sequence. For history, you might want to just check your school library for science and history books. You might be able to pull some things in that you could just use at story time. We use the Living History threads, and I highly recommend it. If your school's not using it, you should check it out and maybe ask them about using it. However, it's maybe not a feasible option for everyone. But if your school is not using it, I saw they had catalogs of the program out here on the table. Pick one up. It's a wonderful resource of read-alouds for age-appropriate levels. Use some ideas from that. Bring those books in for story time if you don't have time to teach history other ways. And children kind of like to learn about, well, I teach Martin Luther and the 95 Theses, and they really don't know what it's about, but they think they have a good idea of what Reformation means. So they like to have some exposure to some grand ideas. Art class. Use art class to teach some basic art principles. It's not just always fun. Art class can be fun. Children like to paint, and they like to marker and draw most of the time if you encourage them to draw. And you don't have to be an art specialist to teach first grade art. You can probably make your project look better than theirs. And actually, I've decided it's actually good to not have the perfect art project with first graders, because then they start thinking that theirs isn't as good as the teacher's. Use varied mediums like crayons and paint and paper and clay. And as I was looking at this picture last night, I realized I should throw this tip out that I wish somebody would have told me years ago. Painting is messy, and not everybody remembers to wear old clothes or to bring a paint shirt. So last year, my co-teacher and I got the bright idea to go to secondhand stores, buy men's shirts for a couple dollars, and now we have our paint shirts at school all the time. So that's why you see them in funny-looking shirts. A good place to get art ideas, and I didn't remember to include this in your handout, but there's a website called artprojectsforkids.org, and that lady has a lot of step-by-step drawings. She's a public school art teacher, and some of her things are for older students, but she has a lot of projects for younger students. Music class. Make it fun. Most young children like to sing. Now, whether they can stay on key or not is a different story, but At first grade, a lot of them have not become sensitive to the fact that somebody else thinks they can't sing, or they can't sing as well as somebody else, or Johnny over here can't sing, or unless they have big brothers and sisters who are critical of their singing. That can be a problem sometimes. Use games. Experiment with your head voice. Experiment with solo voice. Might be a little intimidating for a first grader to sing a solo. And when I'm saying a solo, I'm thinking more, I might sing a tune to them, like, I'll just make it up out of my head, like, what is 2 plus 2? And so then they can sing 2 plus 2 is 4, and they can do whatever they want to with it. They might just say 2 plus 2 is 4, and, well, okay, or 2 plus 2 is 4, but some of them get really carried away and put all kinds of twirls and it's easier for first graders to do that than fifth or sixth graders, so get them used to their solo voice in first grade. Use singing games, but be gentle with criticism. You need to steer them into singing the right way, especially if they're being a little bit contrarian, obnoxious. But do it gently. Don't squelch their singing enthusiasm in first grade, even though they really are making everything sound bad. We in our school program, I had a couple boys who really like to sing, but they don't have any singing ability at all at this point. And we had to really back them away from the mics because that was all that was coming through. But I tried to do it very carefully so that they weren't squelched. I used the music program by Fern Ebersole with Glad Voices. Does anybody use that here? Okay, good. Glad to see that. Now, there's a lot there. Some of it I'm not comfortable enough with. I understand the theory, but I can't think fast enough on my feet to teach it to my students. Okay. So I can't cover all of the material, but I do like what the core part of that. Maybe you have a music teacher in your school that does a wonderful job with. Maybe you don't have to worry about teaching music. Now, I have memory work as an extra. It really shouldn't be an extra, but it's not reading, writing, arithmetic. A lot of your schools probably have a set program. They're saying your students need to have memorized this. We don't at our school, which I wish we did. But even if you don't have a set program, don't cheat your students out of having the knowledge of those verses in their heads. I have a set selection of verses that I do every year, and poems. Include poems in their memory work. I like to have the students work on the whole piece at one time. I know a lot of people don't like that idea, but I have to read it to them several times anyway. So I have their memory work on a poster, and I just read over it, and we try to do this a couple of times a day. I at least try to do it in the morning and before we go home in the evening. It would be good if it was sandwiched in there some other times. The biggest problem is I get very bored with it after reciting part of Luke 2 every Christmas for however many Christmases. It gets a little weary. Put motions with them. And once you get them started, students will come up with their own motions. I mean, I had children last year who were adding motions to songs that have no motions, and if I didn't have a motion for something, they were putting them in themselves. And that seems to help a lot of students with their memory also. And then I send the piece home for them to work on and practice it. And once I think they know it, I don't necessarily give a set due date. We just work on it until I think they all know it, and then I have them recite it for me. And in the middle of winter, which some of you probably, if you're the farther north you are, the more you might have problems with this. But children enjoy routine. Most children feel more comfortable and secure when things follow the schedule they can depend on. So don't feel like you have to have all these exciting breaks, because guess who's really getting bored? It's not usually the student. It's the teacher who's bored. And then if she's bored, she's going to, that's going to transfer over to the students. But just because students like routine doesn't mean they don't enjoy a few breaks. And sometimes you do get a sense that you have to do something. If not for the student, for the teacher, But keep it small. Don't start a monster. Cookies and milk for snack time one day. Especially if maybe you ask the students to bring cookies and milk. Helps you out, and they like to be included. Now, give the moms a little bit of a heads up before you do that. Some things that we've enjoyed is sledding on the hill outside of our school. We often get only one or two good school sledding snows a year, or good sledding snows a year. So I might even just take a morning and we'll go out and sled, because if I wait till recess, it might be all gone. Show and tell. Stuffed animal day. And the very first slide was our stuffed animal day, and I had them read their stories to their animals and set them different corners. It was quite cute how they were reading to their animals. Dolls and tractors. Play with them at recess. That's all we did. You know, they brought them and we played them. I like to celebrate learning the end of learning to read by making pizza as a class. And I used to think that would be a huge job. I didn't want to tackle it. I've simplified things, and my students have come to expect it, and I think if we don't do it, we're going to have a problem. For one thing, have them bring the ingredients, and I usually assign each one an ingredient. Tell them that if they need to, they can call it, the moms can call around and swap ingredients. Have the hamburger and the sausage fried. Then we take a pie tin. I give them each their lump of dough, and they push it out, and then we go around assembly line style, and they make their pizzas, and we have recess while they bake their pizzas, and then we eat them. It's a little bit of mess, but not as much mess as some of the teachers of older grades that did everything from scratch made it seem. Celebrate Dr. Seuss's birthday. That's on March 2nd. We read Cat in the Hat and make Cat in the Hat hats. A few more quick general tips to keep in mind. These are not your children. And we might have different ideas and different goals for these children than their parents do. Sometimes maybe our ideas are valid, but they're still not our children. And so we need to be careful that we don't disrespect their parents and what their parents are teaching them by what we say or do at school. I mean, maybe one family, I know an issue that came up at our school one time. The teacher was fussing about the one family didn't let their little girls wear light-colored dresses, and she thought this was kind of ridiculous. I don't think she mentioned it to the students, but she was just kind of blowing off to me later, and I'm thinking, well, you know, it really doesn't matter if they don't let their children, their girls wear light-colored dresses or not. I mean, she was thinking it sounded kind of staunch or strict, or I mean, the mom had had a real good reason. She maybe didn't want to scrub so many clothes. So respect the parents. Keep the communication open. Talk to them. I go to church with most of my school parents, so if their child did something amusing during the week, I like to tell them. Maybe that's not a good, maybe you don't see them on a weekly basis. I also started last year sending a newsletter home every day, and not every day, sorry, every week. Sorry, I realized what I said. No, I couldn't do it every day. Sometimes it didn't even happen weekly, but a heads up on things that were coming. If I didn't have anything, maybe what we did the week before, and I put pictures on it. And that's how you get your newsletters read, if you put pictures of your students on. Because I actually had moms calling me at the end of the year and saying, oh, I can't find issue number so-and-so of the newsletter. Would you make me a copy? They wanted to keep it in a book. We haven't talked a lot about discipline. That is a big issue. First grade is probably not as big of an issue as some older grades. And I'm going to say that I probably have less problems with discipline now because I've taught so long. The parents think I know what I'm doing, and they just pretty much convey to their children that whatever Miss Martin says, that's what you need to do. It wasn't that way when I first started teaching. And so if you're a young teacher, teach for a long time and then you can get there. And that doesn't always mean that that solves all the problems. But I don't have very many true discipline hassles. Those little petty things like forgetting to raise their hand or jumping out of their seat when they're not supposed to, that's habits. These are children. They're not perfect children. They're not angels. But what I do, I have their names all on the board. They're on about a 1x3 inch piece of cardstock. It has a magnet on the back, and I use that list of names for a whole lot of things. It's our line leader chart. It's our rewards for saying their memory work. They get stars. At the end of the year, they get to take these things home. But it's a big part of my discipline plan. If a child forgets, and they get a mark after their name, a warning mark, just a warning mark. Two marks means they take some time off recess, and I don't find that it takes a lot of time off recess to make a big deal. They can stay in 2 minutes after their classmates and put their heads down on their desks, and it makes them think. Three marks, more time. I don't have a cutoff that says if you get 4 marks in a day, we're going to send you to the principal's office, because I can have a child get up there in a day, but usually she doesn't or he doesn't in the next day. And the parents, I've done this for long enough, the parents kind of know the routine. So if their child's getting a mark or so, they kind of work on it at home, and they ask their children, or they have siblings, or the child tells them themselves. If it would be an ongoing problem, then I'd do something besides just marks. But the big key to making this whole thing work, I think, is we actually try to keep the marks off the board. And at the end of the day, I forgot to talk about that point. I will get to it in a minute. But at the end of the day, they, as they're going out, if they don't have a mark beside their name, they get a tiny piece of candy. And it's not big. I mean, sometimes it's a lollipop. Sometimes it's 2 Skittles. Or 2 M&Ms. I don't know what it is about just this little tiny thing in today's world that really seems to work. I think maybe more than the candy, candy's part of it, but more than the candy is the recognition they get for going through the whole day. And if there's no marks on the board, we might have a cheering, everybody do some hip hip hoorays or do a round of claps or something like that. And I'll have students in the middle of the day say, "Miss Martin, there's no marks on the board," especially if we've been working with some problem. So I think that probably has as much to do with anything as the candy. But you do want to have clear procedures and teach them well. If you don't do that, you're going to be dealing with a lot of other things, and then have a system for those petty offenses. And if you have larger offenses, they're not going to come along every day. Work on them case by case. Often I just talk to the offenders and we try to work something out. If you're having a problem, if you have an issue where you need like lying or cheating or fighting or something that is more of a problem, and you had to deal with it, make sure you talk to the parents about it. They don't like finding out. They don't like you to tell them, "Oh, we're getting along fine at school," and then find out that you had to discipline their child for lying. Now you can say, "Well, most of the time we're getting along good," but be honest with the parents, because it's kind of tough to be honest with the parents. Even when now most of my parents are younger than me, it's not quite as hard, but I still don't like telling parents that their child's bad at school. And have a good classroom atmosphere. If you have an atmosphere in your classroom that you expect the students are going to do what you want them to do, and they know it, they probably will. And we get to the end of the year. The first graders are done in your room, or done with first grade. They're ready to go on to second grade. But are they? Probably most of your students are going to say, "Sure, they're ready for second grade." But there's might be one or so that you have a question with. I did this year. I don't know that we solved the problem, at all. But here are some things to consider. How independent are they? Can they do their work by themselves? Or are you needing to stand over them to get it done, or to get it done correctly? Do they hand in a book and you take your eraser and erase about everything out that was there and have to do it again? If they're not independent now, they won't be in second grade. kind of grades do they have? And first grade grades are a little bit fuzzy anyway, but if you're giving your students A, B, and even C grades, and then you tell the parents, I don't think Johnny's ready for second grade, his work just isn't good enough, and they say, well, he made a B on his test, his report card says he's doing B work, they're not going to be too happy if you say Johnny's not doing his work well. So what kind of grades do they have? Did they get those grades because you helped them a lot? Where do they fit with their peers? That's maybe not a good way to gauge whether a student passes on or not. But you know, if you have a class, and I've had classes where every student was just a little behind where I would like them to be, they can move up through the grades together. I mean, maybe second grade needs to start off with a review of some first grade work. But if you've got a whole class of bright students, and then you have one child who's really struggling, that child only is going to be more frustrated as the days go by. Do they have a learning problem? There's all kinds of learning problems. Their speech might be delayed. There might be a developmental issue or dyslexia. I worked with all three of those issues this past year. They weren't bad, but they were there. Or are there other learning differences? Just repeating the same things over again might not be beneficial unless the root problem is also addressed. What we decided to do at the end of the year was pass these three students on to second grade. The one little girl, I think she's going to do fine in second grade. The other two, I don't know. And we told parents that maybe they will be repeating second grade. But they're both dealing with issues that are not just understanding the material. So maybe they are going to need tutors as they go through school. I don't know. That's kind of unseen yet. But whatever you do, make sure you have the parents' support. Because if you think Danny needs to repeat and his parents don't, well, it's no point in having Danny repeat if his parents aren't going to back that up, because the child is just going to be confused and nobody's going to be happy. And if you feel the child needs special help or needs to repeat a grade or needs summer work, make sure you talk it over with your school officials, which hopefully you would. We used to have a rather loose structure at our school, and it was a little bit of an issue of who was actually in charge. And it's not like that anymore, thankfully. But make sure everybody's in agreement, especially if you're a young teacher. Ask someone else what they would be doing. I mean, now at our school, that everybody comes and asks me, and I don't know either, so. Okay, we have a couple of minutes for questions and answers, and I know I have quickly gone through first grade, tried to cover some of the basics. Anybody have anything that they'd like to have answered?
Have you ever found, good tips? Like, if you know that a child is slow at halfway, have you found anything that really worked to bring them ahead in the last half of the year?
Well, that doesn't have just a real, real simple answer. Okay. I'll have to tell you about these three students. The one was a speech issue, and her speech improved very much over the year. And as her speech improved, her reading improved. So I think she's going to be fine in second grade. I mean, she's not going to ever be a straight-A student, I don't think. But I'll tell you, it was about March, and I was doing reading, and we had been having frustrating reading classes, frustrating for everybody involved. And finally one day I said, this is it. Something has to change. And so we had some old Pathway reading books up in the attic, and we had the workbooks. And I decided, I was going to wait to the end of the light unit, but I just said, it's going to change tonight. I pulled out those easier books for those three students. that gave them a boost in confidence because it was actually work they could work on. And it was books that weren't really so, I mean, it still got them ready for the end of the year. Anybody else have any good suggestions on how you, I mean, sometimes just working with the problem, making sure you're spending enough time with it. Where those students are also supposed to be doing some summer work this year. Okay. Now, that depends on, you know, I don't know how well all that summer work is going to go because everybody gets busy. It's a little bit like teachers procrastinating on things. But anybody else have any good?
My class is big enough that I'll be doing reading in groups. And I'm not sure. Do you do reading groups or do you have them all together?
It depends a little bit. I was trying to move them all together, but that split them up into groups. Now, I had 11 students last year, so when we're reading stories that are short stories, they have to be in groups. They cannot get enough practice. But at the same time, I still was trying to keep everybody.
I guess my question that goes along with that was, I know some teachers, I was kind of told it's up to me, so
right.
I'm not.
Right.
To decide exactly how I want to do it.
Right.
Some of the teachers, I think the older classes especially, they put them in groups according to their ability, in terms of the slower readers in one group and the faster readers in another group. But the teacher who was there before me, I think at the advice of the teacher who was there before her, split them evenly according to ability because she felt it was good for the faster students to learn patience and the slower students to hear the faster ones
read.
I guess I was just wondering if you have any feedback on which way is better?
I don't know. Has anybody? It kind of goes against my grain to split them up according to according to ability, just because it's not quite how I'm teaching. However, I haven't really done it. So now, you know, I did that. Obviously, was according to ability in their reading. The other subjects, I realized if I break the class into smaller groups, I'm happier, and the students are happier too. But I try to mix and match the good students and the poor students. I don't know. The thing is, after a while, you do learn to know who the poor students, I mean, the classmates know that little whoever down here can't work as well as they can. So, you know, some people say, well, don't split them according to ability because that always labels certain students. I mean, like the story that we heard yesterday. The students still know. At the same time, I don't think it's wrong for the slower learner to also hear the better students. It can help them. I don't have a good answer. Anybody else have a good answer for that one? I leave it. I don't have time to do that. Now, sometimes we will work on a polished piece. Like these booklets, I would say we tried to polish it within reason. But there's words in here that they really should know how to spell that they didn't spell correctly. I think it's okay to point out some things sometimes, but you don't. I would rather have them putting words down. There's always people who can do editing later on in life. Now, that doesn't mean I want them to have sloppy habits either, but getting the words down is more important than having an actual piece. So I would say that, yes, I would probably clean up a few pieces during the year. I was in Sharon Yoder's Peeking in My Booklet class, and she was talking about that a little bit yesterday. She teaches 5 and 6, and she says, she tries to do one piece of polished work every quarter. So, you know, that's maybe 4 or 5 pieces a year. Because pretty soon if they have to have it perfect, and some children can't have it perfect, they're going to say, well, I don't want to write then. Well, God bless you as you enjoy the adventure. And first grade is an adventure. And if anyone has any questions and would like to talk to me later, or, you know, if you're in the school year and you think, oh, well, what should I do about this, feel free to send me an email. I might have the answers and I might not, but and there's some other teachers around that have taught for many years. Feel free to pick their brains. So you're dismissed.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.